The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Good evening, and welcome to The Business of Giving. I'm your host, Denver Frederick, and thank you for joining me. Tonight, we are going to discuss effective altruism with perhaps the best-known person associated with this movement. He is Peter Singer, a professor of bioethics at Princeton University, and the author of The Life You Can Save, How to Do Your Part to End World Poverty.
Effective altruism is a philosophy that says we ought to live our lives so that at least one of our important aims is to make the world a better place. That we're not just living for ourselves, we're not even just living for our family and those close to us, but thinking about the world as a whole is something that's important to do.
And then I'll be joined by Kathleen Enright, the president and CEO of the Council on Foundations, who shares this observation about philanthropy.
But, you know, at the very heart of it, we have to take into consideration the fact that philanthropy itself comes out of the fact that there is economic inequality. You know, philanthropy is a product of economic inequality.
But first, the Business of Giving News Digest for Sunday, December 15th. The Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation has announced that CEO Sue Desmond-Hellman is stepping down after 5.5 years. Mark Sussman, the foundation's president of global policy and its chief strategy officer, will succeed her. Tufts has announced it will remove the Sackler name, that's the one connected with Purdue Pharma and the opioid crisis, from its programs and buildings. New York City now spends a record $338,000 to incarcerate one person for 1 year, roughly $925 a day. That figure represents an 85% increase since 2014. For adults between 18 and 49, flu vaccination rates are abysmal, just under 27% for the 2017-18 season, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. The states with the highest volunteer rate are Utah, Minnesota, Oregon, Iowa, and Alaska. The lowest, well, those would include Mississippi, Nevada, New York, and California. And finally, and on a very sad note, Peter Freitas, who used his ALS diagnosis to help make the Ice Bucket Challenge go viral, has died. He was just 34. And that is the Business of Giving News Digest for this Sunday evening. I'll be back with Peter Singer right after this.
Top companies have now begun to discover a reliable source for skilled new talent, and they're finding great success with employees who are productive, engaged, and innovative. Explore the country's largest untapped talent pool, 24 million Americans with disabilities. The National Organization on Disability is the leading partner for companies looking to accelerate their disability employment efforts, attract, hire, and retain. Learn more at NOD.org.
Do you remember your first job? Year Up is empowering low-income young adults with the skills and experience to get their first job. 85% of alumni are employed or in school within 4 months of graduation. Support opportunity for all. Visit yearup.org.
Follow the Business of Giving on Twitter at BizOfGive and at Facebook.com/BusinessOfGiving. And now, back to the Business of Giving with your host, Denver Frederick, on AM 970, The Answer.
It was 10 years ago that the book, The Life You Can Save, How to Do Your Part to End World Poverty, shook the world of philanthropy and got people everywhere to think about their own giving in an entirely different way. And his impact has been such that a 10th anniversary edition, which has been updated, has just come out. Its author is Peter Singer, the Ira W. DeCamp Professor of Bioethics at Princeton University, and considered by many to be the world's most influential living philosopher. And he is with us now. Good evening, Peter, and welcome to the Business of Giving.
Good evening, Denver. Good to be with you.
You know, as a philosopher, Peter, there are many roads to go down. So what got you first interested in seeing that people use their charitable dollars in a fashion that would relieve the greatest amount of suffering and do the most good?
I was interested in philosophy being practical, that is, in it having an impact in the world. I never wanted to study philosophy just for the sake of my own learning or even of influencing just my academic colleagues. So when I was a graduate student in Oxford, it was at the time of the crisis in what was then East Pakistan and became Bangladesh, mm-hmm. when the Pakistani army repressed the autonomy movement of Bangladesh or of East Pakistan, and 9 million refugees fled across the border from that oppression, across the border into India. And India appealed for help to look after this vast number of people that they'd suddenly acquired and had to shelter and feed and so on. And there wasn't really enough forthcoming. So I started thinking, you know, what are my obligations as somebody who, you know, I was only a graduate student living on a scholarship, but still I was comfortable and I did have some spare cash. What are my obligations to do something about this situation, to help people? And I started writing about that, and I contributed an article called Famine, Affluence, and Morality to what was then a completely new journal called Philosophy and Public Affairs, uh-huh. which was trying to get philosophers involved in public affairs, as the title suggests. So that's really what got me started, thinking about what are our obligations as people who are comfortably off in wealthy countries to people in extreme poverty. And it's all gone from there.
Yeah. Well, one of the most famous thought experiments that you're known for is the drowning child. Share that with us, if you would.
Right. That comes from the article I just mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
In order to get across to people the idea that we do have responsibilities to help, even if we're not actually the cause of the problem, I asked my readers to imagine that they're walking across a park, that there's a pond in the park, that they know that it's quite a shallow pond, and suddenly they see that there's a small child who's fallen into that pond. And, of course, you would look around at first for the parents or the babysitter who's looking after this little child, but just assume that there isn't anyone there. You don't know how the child got into the pond. It's not your child, but here's a child in danger of drowning because although the pond is shallow, it's too deep for that child. But you could easily rush into the pond and grab the child and pull the child out and save the child's life. There is a small cost to doing that, though, because you're wearing your best clothes, you've just got dressed up to go somewhere fancy, and you don't have time to get them off. But if you wade into this muddy pond, they're going to get ruined.
Mm-hmm.
So you'll have to replace some of your clothes if you do this. Now, then I ask the readers to think, well, would it be okay to say, look, that's not my child. I'm not responsible. I didn't put the child in the pond, and I don't want to ruin my clothes just to save this stranger. And when I ask people that, they respond, no, that's not a – you can't compare your clothes to a child's life. That's not an excuse for ignoring the child. That would be a terribly wrong thing to do. You really ought to rush into the pond and help the child. So, you know, once I've got people to agree to that, then I say, okay, but for a similar kind of cost, maybe you can save the life of a child somewhere else in the world. It's not a child right in front of you. It's not a child you can see. But by donating to an effective organization, you can still do it. So if it's wrong not to help the child, why isn't it wrong not to do something for those who are further away but whose life is also in danger and who you could help?
Well, that will cause people to pause for a minute or two. And that crystallizes the essence of effective altruism. How would you define that?
Effective altruism is a philosophy that says we ought to live our lives so that at least one of our important aims is to make the world a better place. That we're not just living for ourselves, we're not even just living for our family and those close to us, but thinking about the world as a whole is something that's important to do. And when we do that, so that's the altruism part, obviously, when we do that, whatever resources we're prepared to put into that, whether it's time, energy, skills, or money, we ought to try to make sure that they're as effective as possible in doing as much good as we can with those resources. And to do that, we need to draw on evidence and reasoning to think about what is the best cause and within that, what is the most effective organization that I can support or work with to make the biggest possible positive difference in the world.
Yeah, and I guess part of that concept you're just talking about is that all lives have equal value. Would that be correct?
That's right. That the fact that somebody is living far away in another country, the fact that they're of a different ethnic group or a different religion, is not a reason for thinking that it's less important whether they die or their children die or whether they can see or go blind or get a malaria or don't get malaria. These things are equally important wherever you are and whoever you are.
Well, let's talk about going blind. I have a very good friend who works for a organization that trains guided dogs. She tells me it's about $50,000 to train one of these dogs, and it's a wonderful organization, a worthwhile organization. They provide freedom and independence to an individual to live their lives. Is there a better way to spend that $50,000 than on training a guided dog for a single individual?
Yes, there is a better way, and it's tough to say it because I admire people like your friend who are working to help others. That's a good thing to do, and there's no doubt that having a guide dog helps somebody who's blind. But it isn't as good as getting your sight restored or as not going blind in the first place. I think anybody who's blind with a guide dog would rather have their sight back. And when we look at the cost, as you say, $50,000, it's expensive to train a guide dog because it takes a lot of time and effort. And you know, when you compare that with either doing a simple cataract operation on somebody who is already blind but can't get that operation done because they're in a low-income country and they don't have the money, or compare it with preventing people going blind from trachoma, which is the largest single cause of preventable blindness in the world, both of these procedures are really quite inexpensive. Mm-hmm. Let's say $100, right? So you compare that $100 to restore someone's sight or prevent someone going blind with $50,000 for providing a guide dog, and you can see that there's 500 people whose sight could be restored for the cost of training one guide dog. And therefore, you know, I'm going to say, an effective altruist will say, we really ought to pick the low-hanging fruit here. We really ought to use our resources to do the most good. And the way the world is at present, that's not donating to support guide dog organizations.
Yeah, that is so interesting, Peter. So let me ask you what an effective altruist would say about this. So if I'm walking through the park and I see that child drowning, but I'm running late to give a speech, and I'm going to get paid $1 million for that speech, and I've already declared that I'm going to give that $1 million to the Against Malaria Foundation. But if I don't get there in time, I won't get that opportunity. What should I do?
That's emotionally very tough, right? Because, of course, an effective altruist is going to have to say, you ought to give the speech and get the $1 million because, as I just said, that can save a large number of lives. You know, we've been talking about restoring sight in people. So that could be 10,000 people whose sight you could restore, or mm-hmm. in terms of saving lives, maybe that's somewhat more expensive, but it's still, let's say, going to be 1,000 people or something like that whose lives you could save. So that is better than saving one life.
Mm-hmm.
But emotionally, to actually walk past that child and say that child is going to drown is very tough. And I don't know that, you know, looking at you, I don't know that I would want you to be the kind of person who could just ignore that child. So that's the dilemma. But if you really imagine it as a hypothetical situation that you could do that and those would be the consequences,
yeah.
I'm going to have to say, don't let the $1 million go. If this is the only chance you have to get it and to donate it mm-hmm. to effective charities, that actually is better than rescuing the child.
Yeah, yeah. You know what I find so interesting about this, too, is that we're always comparing one charity to another. So if I want to save the whales, I'm going to look at 8 organizations to save the whales and see which one is doing the best job. But if I'm not wrong, effective altruists are really comparing one cause to another. Would that be correct? And deciding what cause is actually going to do the most good as opposed to a charity within a cause?
Well, certainly effective altruists will look first at the question, what cause is going to do the most good? Once you have decided that,
mm-hmm.
then sure, you do want to look at whether some of the organizations working in that cause are more effective than others. But yeah, in a way, the more difficult question, because it involves – questions of values to compare different causes. That's the question that effective altruists have probably spent most time on. And then when they find a good cause, they go and look at one of the organizations like GiveWell or like The Life You Can Save, which I founded, to find which are the most effective charities working in that cause.
Yeah. No, the rigor that you guys put to this is unbelievable. Here's another issue that people might have, and it's trying to circle this, you know, the square about effective altruism. Loyalty and gratitude play an important role. So an individual goes to college on a scholarship, wouldn't have been able to go otherwise, gets a great foundation of an education, becomes successful, makes a lot of money, and feels loyalty to that institution. Or a parent's child was saved by a local cancer hospital in their town. So the two things that come into play are loyalty and gratitude. How do they address those while also trying to adhere to many of the principles of effective altruism?
Look, I think we have many motivations for giving, and they're not all compatible with effective altruism.
Mm-hmm.
And just as, you know, effective altruists are not saints. I don't want to give anyone the impression that everything they do all the time is directed towards doing the most good in the world. You know, maybe there are one or two people I know who come very close to that. But,
well, it's one or two more than I know.
Right. But the great majority of them are not like that. So, you know, they're spending money on things that aren't doing a lot of good in the world. So certainly, you know, you can, if you want to, spend some money on things that are doing some good but not the most good. And, you know, donating to your alma mater, right? I teach at Princeton. I'm not a Princeton graduate, but I'm often asked by my students because they get, you know, they're being lined up for these approaches from the development office at Princeton, should I donate to Princeton University? Well, what I say to them is, look, if that's something you want to do, if you feel, you know, some loyalty or some gratitude to the institution that has educated you so well, sure, you know, do a little bit of that, but don't confuse that with effective altruism, because Princeton has an endowment that over $20 billion at the moment. I think it goes up and down a little bit. But, yeah, it's not really – Princeton is a wonderful institution, but it has basically what it needs to continue to be a wonderful mm-hmm. institution. And you're not going to make much difference. Whereas there are other things you can do where your donation will make a much more significant difference to specific people. And so I say reserve – you know, the bulk of your giving, I think, should be giving as effectively as possible. And regard the other things, whether it's for your university or, you know, the hospital that supported your relative when she had breast cancer, regard that as something different, a different sort of pocket of money, which you want to do, and that's okay. But otherwise, I'd say, yeah, reserve most of what you can afford to give for where it will do the most good.
Yeah, that's a wonderfully balanced and common sense answer. And I think that's what you're really saying is effective altruism. There has to be some common sense that imbues that in terms of your own proclivities and loyalties. But it really provides a wonderful guide in terms of how to think about your charitable giving. You know, there's another issue, I think, that sometimes when people talk about the life you can save, they may say, well, you know, that's a bit paternalistic. It's a bit outdated. People in the developing world do not need to be saved by the dollars of the Western world. It just reinforces the power imbalance between donor and recipient. How would you respond to that?
I just don't think it's true that there are no people in developing countries whose lives can be saved by donations to effective charities from the developed world,
mm-hmm.
And those lives will be lost. They are being lost as we're talking, because the donations are not sufficient. So, you know, you can look at malaria as an example. When people, and especially children, sleep under bed nets to protect them from malaria, they're less likely to die. That's statistically proven. And yet not all of the places where malaria is prevalent have been covered in terms of distribution of bed nets. So if we don't do it, it's not going to happen, or it's not going to happen for some time. And during that time, people are going to die.
Yeah. You had mentioned a moment ago that the Life You Can Save.org, you've started an organization, and I have been so impressed at the rigor that you've brought to analyzing and reviewing these organizations. Tell us what you look at and how you determine your recommendations, which are front and center on your homepage if somebody comes to visit.
Yes. So we have drawn on research that has been done by others. We do not have the capacity to have our own full-time professional researchers, but we draw on research that's done by others. You might have noticed the Nobel Memorial Prize for Economics this year went to Esther Duflo and yes. Abhijit Banerjee and Michael Kremer, researchers who've been doing randomized controlled trials on anti-poverty interventions.
Right, they're at the MIT Poverty Lab, would they be?
That's right, yes, mm-hmm. yes. And Michael Kremer is at Harvard, but mm-hmm. yeah. So that kind of research started off this idea of doing more rigorous research on which interventions help. It's been taken up by GiveWell, which does have the resources to have a team of researchers working on this. And so we draw on their recommendations to a considerable extent. We're a little broader than GiveWell, and we do accept other organizations which have been audited and evaluated in other ways as being highly effective in terms of their anti-poverty interventions. So we have a panel of experts who looks at that evidence drawn from various sources and selects the organizations that we want to be recommending.
Well, you have an impressive group of people reviewing this and an impressive group of recipients. How would you weigh the Against Malaria Foundation, which ostensibly can save a person's life, with GiveDirectly, which are basically going to be direct cash transfers to lift the standard of living of a person? How does one weigh between mortality and increasing income?
Yeah, those are difficult questions, and they both these organizations relate to working with people in extreme poverty. And they both do different things. Giving bed nets against malaria doesn't only save lives. It does save lives, and that's the sort of thing that is up front and center, that you can save a child's life. But, of course, it prevents other people getting malaria, who not everybody who gets malaria dies. And malaria is a really debilitating disease. I happen to have had malaria myself. I went up to New Guinea when I was in my late teens, I think, and I picked up malaria there, and it certainly knocked me around for a while. But, of course, I was back in Australia by the time it hit me, and I had excellent medical attention. And I think I had about 3 bouts of it. It came back a couple of times. But, yeah, you feel terrible and weak. And if I hadn't been able to get the right drugs, I would have had that for much longer. So there is a big quality of life impact in preventing people getting malaria, and they can work better and provide better. So in that sense, some of that is comparable to what GiveDirectly does. They're handing out cash transfers mm-hmm. to people, and they're, again, rigorously examining what happens to people or to villages in which the poorest people get cash transfers as compared with others where they don't. And they're, of course, aware of problems like creating dependence. They're aware of the idea that was floated around before they really started, that if you give people cash, they'll spend it on alcohol or gambling or prostitutes or something like that. So they had to test all of that very, very rigorously. And it turns out that that doesn't happen, that people spend the money often on capital goods that they could not otherwise have afforded, like getting a tin roof for their house where they just had a thatched roof. Having a tin roof saves you money in the long run because mm-hmm. it lasts longer. But unless you can, get $300 together, you can't afford it. And for families that are on maybe $700 to $1,000 a year, you can't save $300. So, that makes a clear difference to their quality of life. And then, there's been research following up, finding out what happens. Do their children go to school more often? Do they eat better? Do they have more assets in the long run? So you have to look at those indications. And even when you do, it's still hard to say. In a sense, some people will say, well, I'm still going to prefer the intervention that is more likely to save a life than the one that is more likely to give a family a better quality of life. But I think you could go either way on that, because after all, if people get out of poverty, they're likely to have also healthier lives. They're likely perhaps to have better sanitation, better nutrition, so their children will be stronger to resist diseases mm-hmm. that are still going to be around. So it's pretty difficult to make that call, and that's why we recommend both Give Directly and the Against Malaria Foundation.
Yeah, I was a little surprised that Give Directly, in terms of alcohol and tobacco use, it in fact went down, which was really impressive, you know, when you think about it, because it was completely contrary to what many people said what would happen.
Yeah.
Because I think they saw opportunity in their lives to do something, and they just became more diligent and more productive. So it's really...
I think that might be right, that if you feel that you're stuck in a situation where nothing is ever going to change, then you might as well have a drink now and again and forget about it and get some pleasure here or there, right? But if you think, I'm really got a path where I can get out of this situation, get my family out of this situation.
I have a cow. I can do something.
Yeah. Whatever little business opportunity it is that now that you can start, I think people will go for that as best they can.
You're not just a book and you're not just an organization. You are a movement. I mean, I get so many emails from the Effective Altruist community. I can't believe it. Tell me about your adherents. I mean, where's the energy coming from? Who are these people who are really engaged in effective altruism?
This is quite a new movement, and it's interesting. In the 10 years since I first published The Life You Can Save, and one of the things that I'll be talking about in the new edition, though, that's just out now, is the rise of this movement pretty much within that 10-year period. It was just starting, but really hardly anybody had heard of it in 2009. Now we have a worldwide movement with groups all over the world, not just in rich nations like the United States and Canada and Europe and Australia, but also groups in a number of Asian countries, in Latin American countries too. And they're mostly very young. So some of these groups started out as campus groups, started by undergraduates. Here in the United States, for example, I think Rutgers in New Jersey was the first campus group, and then it spread from there. And then there are people who've, you know, been through that and are now in their 20s and in careers and are earning and donating. But it's very much still a young movement. It's a well-educated movement. I would say that a majority of our people have university education. And perhaps quite a number of them are in sort of the tech areas, IT, startups, and so on.
Yeah.
Disproportionately so. It's got around in those areas. But it certainly attracts other people who are not in those areas but were interested in giving and interested in doing good in their lives and have joined groups. There are a number of independent groups and chapters around the world, and I think that supports people in what they're doing.
Yeah, a lot of rational people, a lot of math majors I've noticed in the notes that I've been getting, you know, because they look at this in a very quantitative and a very effective way. And I don't want to say their emotions are not involved, because they are, but they're also really getting their head into their giving.
I think it's a combination of heart and head.
Yeah,
yes,
it is.
But you're right. It's interesting that you observe that, because I've noticed that too, that I think people who come from maths or, again, computer science kind of backgrounds are perhaps, you know, quicker to get the idea that, you know, yes, I want to do more good. It's not enough that I see a pamphlet with a picture of a smiling child and think, yes, this is a good organization. I'll donate to them. I really need more data. I really need to know that this organization is doing, you know, exactly what they're doing with my donation, and that's better than other organizations would do.
Let me ask you one more thing about effective altruism and animals. I think it was Jonathan Bentham who believed that every living thing, including animals, should count as one and not more than one. And there are effective altruists who believe that the interests of non-human animals should be accorded the same moral weight as humans and work to prevent the suffering of animals. You have spoken and written about this extensively. How do you look at it?
Yes, I certainly look at animal suffering as something that is a bad thing and that we ought to reduce. You asked me earlier about how we compare causes. This is another one that's very difficult to compare because, you know, part of the argument is that there's such vast amount of animal suffering. In the United States alone, there's something like 8 billion chickens produced each year. 99.999% of those are indoors in factory farms, extremely crowded. And organizations have been effective in trying to improve animal welfare and trying to get big corporations to avoid factory farm products and provide alternatives. It's a work in progress, but it's getting somewhere. So, you know, if you have the choice, you say, well, look, I could save hundreds of thousands of chickens from weeks of suffering in these crowded conditions, or I could save one child's life. How are you going to decide that? And I don't have any real way of saying what's the right decision in that comparison. But, you know, people will have their different preferences. And if they are concerned about animal welfare, as I think we all should be to some extent, then, again, we have an organization that does that evaluation. It's called Animal Charity Evaluators, and you can find that, animalcharityevaluators.org. And they are assessing which organizations are the most effective. And one other thing I'll add, if you're interested in being effective in the animal field, part of the problem here is that, as I've been saying, the vast majority of animals suffering is inflicted on farmed animals, on chickens and pigs and cows in particular. But the vast majority of the money donated to animal welfare groups in the United States goes to dog and cats, to shelter organizations, to organizations that are helping to rescue stray dogs and cats. And that's really, really disproportionate, not only to the number of animals suffering, but to the type of suffering. So I would like to redress this balance a bit. You know, again, I would say, as I said, with people wanting to give to their university or to the hospital that looked after their sick relative, you know, if you care about dogs and cats, fine, give something to them. But don't forget about the 99% of animal suffering, which is inflicted on farmed animals. And think about the excellent organizations like the Humane League or Mercy for Animals in the United States that are focused on farmed animals and are really doing excellent work in reducing their suffering.
Yeah, you're looking to get people to ask themselves questions that they perhaps never had thought of before. Let me close with this, Peter. Why did you feel it was important to issue this anniversary edition of The Life You Can Save? And what are you saying now about this movement that you weren't able to say 10 years ago?
Well, there is a lot more information out there now, and there is this new movement, as we were just saying, the Effective Altruism Movement, which has helped to provide more information. And in fact, the organization, The Life You Can Save, didn't exist in 2009 because it spun off the publication of the book. So one of the things that I'm saying now is we have a lot more data about which are the effective organizations, and I can talk about some of the different things that those effective organizations are doing, and I can provide evidence for the good that they're doing, which wasn't there. I can also talk about connecting people to the effective altruism movement and how to be effective in this area. So I feel that the book, I think it had a strong basis 10 years ago, but I think it has a much stronger basis still in terms of the evidence that's available now than it did when I first wrote it.
Well, you've come a long way, and you are still in the early innings. Well, Peter Singer, the Ira W. DeCamp Professor of Bioethics at Princeton University, and the author of The Life You Can Save, How to Do Your Part to End World Poverty, thanks so much for being here this evening. Now, is it true that people can access this book for free? And if so, how do they go about doing that?
Yes, that is true. They couldn't do that with the first edition, but we, the organization The Life You Can Save, has bought back the rights from the publisher precisely because we want to have the widest possible readership and we don't want cost to be a deterrence. So although if you want a print book, we have to charge for that, and that should be in bookstores, or you can get it online. But obviously there's cost in producing it. We can't give that away. But we can give away both an e-book and an audiobook where the chapters are read by well-known celebrities. So Paul Simon, for example, of Simon & Garfunkel reads a chapter. Kristen Bell and Mike Schur of The Good Place read chapters. Stephen Fry, a BBC broadcaster who's well-known to people in England, reads a chapter. I like the fact we have an African woman, Winnie Alma, reading a chapter. I like the fact that there's a lot of different English accents going on in this book, you know, American English, my Australian one, I read a chapter, an African woman, an Indian actress, Shabana Azmi. So it's really a diverse book in itself. Now, how do people get this? It's very simple. They just go to www.thelifeyoucansave.org and they will find a link there for downloading either the ebook or the audiobook, or if you want to, get them both and tell your friends about it too. They can get it as well.
Well, thanks, Peter, for a great conversation. It was a real pleasure to have you on the program.
Thanks very much, Denver. It's been great talking to you.
I'll be back with more of The Business of Giving right after this.
Technology can change lives, but underserved communities around the world have yet to experience all the benefits technology offers. Benetech is a nonprofit whose mission is to empower communities in need by creating scalable technology solutions. Learn more by visiting benetech.org.
Before you give to charity, go to CharityNavigator.org. Charity Navigator provides free ratings of thousands of America's largest charities, helping you get the most out of your charitable dollar. CharityNavigator.org, your guide to intelligent giving.
Follow The Business of Giving on Twitter at BizOfGive and at Facebook.com/BusinessOfGiving. And now, back to The Business of Giving with your host, Denver Frederick, on AM 970, The Answer.
Can you help me remember how to smile?
The impact that foundations have in the field of philanthropy is even greater than the cumulative value of all the grants they make. They often provide the leadership for the sector that influences what and how things get done. And one of the most important organizations in that ecosystem is the Council on Foundations. And it's a pleasure to have with us tonight their president and CEO, Kathleen Enright. Good evening, Kathleen, and welcome to The Business of Giving.
Denver, thanks so much for inviting me.
The Council was founded back in 1943. What does the organization do?
The Council exists to help philanthropy be a strong and trusted partner in advancing the greater good. We are an advocate for philanthropy up on the Hill so that there's a supportive ecosystem that so that philanthropy can grow and expand. We also help support the field in displaying high integrity and earning and maintaining the public's trust. We do this by strengthening the bonds between funders. We represent a diverse and varied group of grant makers, and we help them navigate the regulatory environment in the U.S. and around the world so that they can do their work to the best of their ability.
What do you believe is the most common misunderstanding that people have about foundations?
You know, sometimes folks think that foundations are only the biggest of the big, like the Bill and Melinda Gates foundations. But the foundations come in all shapes and sizes, mm-hmm. and many of them are created in a variety of ways. Like health conversion foundations.
Yeah.
Those come out of the sale of a hospital or health system. Some are very small. And also, philanthropy does not have to be institutionalized.
Mm-hmm.
Philanthropy happens by individuals every day. Denver, I bet you're a philanthropist. I bet you give money to causes that you care about.
Mm-hmm.
I give money to causes that I care about. So it happens in communities across the country and around the world. And it's part of what makes America unique.
That's
and great.
Right. Yeah. And it's not only money, it's time as well.
That's true.
Yeah,
there's a lot of different
philanthropy
forms.
Is getting a broader and broader, I think, definition in the public's mind. Are you a membership organization?
We are. We're a membership organization.
How many members?
We have about 720 at the moment.
Okay. And counting.
Yes. I was going to say I didn't check today.
Yeah. Well, a few of the issues that the Council on Foundations is engaged, let's talk about a couple of them. One would be economic inclusion. That's mm-hmm. becoming increasingly important. We sometimes think that it happened right downstairs where Zuccotti Park is, because that's where Occupy Wall Street was.
Mm-hmm.
And although sometimes people looked at that as being kind of an it really did set off this whole thing about economic inclusion. What are you doing in that regard to help engage the foundations and your members to try to be a more active partner in that?
You know, there's a lot of different ways that our members are working on that. Some of them are doing more traditional work related to access to jobs,
mm-hmm.
Sustainable wages, et cetera. And so we are helping them learn from one another. But, you know, at the very heart of it, we have to take into consideration the fact that philanthropy itself comes out of the fact that there is economic inequality. You know, philanthropy is a product of economic inequality. So we're trying to help explore the fact that exists and
mm-hmm.
that we need to take a very deep look at what that means and whether and if philanthropy needs to take a broader approach at addressing it. Some of our members are more interested in opportunity zones at the moment, and so the Rockefeller Foundation is one of those. They've been very seriously trying to make sure that opportunity zones are community-driven and that they are really benefiting those that they are intended to serve, rather than
tax
seen as tax write-offs for those who make the investments there. And so that's one thing. That's one way in which some of our members are taking advantage of a federal government program that's trying to decrease the economic inequality.
Mm-hmm. You know, Kathleen, that as a society, we pretty much have stopped talking with people who disagree with us. Rather, we're talking at them.
Yeah.
And now people are looking to philanthropy to say, is there something that we can do to help build bridges? Speak a little bit about that.
Yes, I think that's something that our members are thinking very, very carefully about. And I am personally committed to finding ways for the council to serve a role there.
Mm-hmm.
One of the unique values that I keep hearing that the council can provide, given that we are seen as such a big tent and we are nonpartisan and we convene foundations who might be seen as supporting causes that might be more right-leaning and more left-leaning,
mm-hmm.
That we can possibly help our members have conversations across difference that can lead to more productive solutions. So we have been dipping our toes in that water and supporting some of those conversations. We released a report alongside the Kettering Foundation earlier this year at our conference that shares some early insights mm-hmm. along those lines. But our members are modeling some of the way forward. You know, the Koch Brothers Foundation, they're not a member at this moment, but they have been working with on criminal justice reform with what others might characterize as more left-leaning foundations who are working on criminal justice
reform.
They've
been champions of that, really, for a long time now.
Exactly. And so I think that there is a sense that some of these deeply entrenched societal problems are not going to move forward unless we look at them from the perspective of where might there be common ground,
mm-hmm.
where might many of us agree on what some of the solutions are.
And I think sometimes what we do is we spend too much time analyzing their motivations.
Mm-hmm.
And at the end of the day, as you just said, if you can find that common ground and get stuff done to improve a condition, that's what really counts.
Yes, exactly.
Mm-hmm. You have your toes in a lot of pools of water. One of those would be the Sustainable Development Goals. Obviously, philanthropy has to play a role in helping meet those 17 goals put forth by the UN.
Mm-hmm.
How have you been working in that regard with your members there?
You know, several of my colleagues were just up at the UN General Assembly and meeting with many of our members to advance that work there. The Hilton Foundation has been a real leader in advancing the Sustainable
mm-hmm.
Development Goals over many years. And one of the ways that we're trying to advance that work is to help people see that this is not just an international issue, it's a domestic issue, that you can incorporate the Sustainable Development Goals into your citywide strategy. And community foundations are often taking some leadership there and thinking through how do the Sustainable Development Goals apply to our local area, and how can we play a role in incorporating them into our thinking and into our community plan?
Mm-hmm. We have had a number of CEOs from foundations on the show, such as F.B. Heron,
mm-hmm.
The Ford Foundation, the Cerdna Foundation, and those, among others, are really in the forefront of impact investing and program-related
mm-hmm.
investing. How much is that spreading across the foundation world?
You know, in the course of my time in philanthropy, impact investing, using the 95% of the assets
yeah.
in addition to the 5% or therein, you know, around that amount of grant making, has really transformed the way that grant makers are thinking about their work. Heron has been a huge leader on that front under Clara Miller's leadership and others. I think that it is expanding greatly.
Mm-hmm.
And my sense, though, is that for many grant makers who are just getting started, thinking first about getting brilliant on the basics of doing the grant making makes a lot of sense.
Yes.
Before you
get in some of the exotic ways of get the meat and potatoes down first.
Veer off into the worlds of of those kinds of investments. It makes sense to just ensure that you're doing right by your grantees, that you're setting up grants in the way that makes the most sense for them, that you're streamlining reporting requirements, that you're opting for general operating support, all of those kinds of things.
Yeah, and an interesting byproduct of that, and I remember Clara spoke about that, is that within her own organization, when they did that 100% commitment mm-hmm. of all their assets to doing social good, she said it broke down the silos in the organization, mm-hmm. that the investment people and the program people would meet at the Christmas party, mm-hmm. and now they were working together and really helping each other. So there's a lot of benefits that come from that, both externally and internally.
Yeah, certainly. And I'm not at all trying to dissuade any foundation from going down that path. I just think there's a time and organizational life cycle when it makes sense.
I can't agree with you more. Philanthropy has become more global, both in terms of cross-border grant making and really applying a global perspective to what we're doing mm-hmm. here at home. What are you able to do there to assist?
You know, the Council's role has been for several years to support U.S.-based grantmakers as they do work abroad.
Mm-hmm.
And since I took this job 7 months ago, I've heard from many of our members and others that they've really appreciated the work that we've done, particularly post-9/11, to help them respond to the increasing regulations and requirements of doing grant making overseas. So we have are committed to continue to support grant makers in those lights. And additionally, we are hoping to figure out the ways that we can learn from those emerging civil societies overseas and the foundations that are growing up in many different countries. I'm sure that there's plenty that philanthropy in the U.S. can learn from the philanthropic organizations in many other countries.
Share with us your observations and insights around risk. Because people sometimes look at foundations as being the passing lane of society. They can roll the dice a little bit more. On the other hand, you hear people say they can be some of the most conservative organizations. And I don't mean that in the political sense. What do you see?
You know, the bottom line for me on risk is that the way that people define risk related to philanthropy is often wrongheaded.
Mm-hmm.
The people who bear the brunt of the risk related to foundations are those who are either well-served or ill-served by the investments that foundations decide to make or not to make. So, you know, in the highly publicized investment by Mark Zuckerberg
mm-hmm.
in the New York public schools, it was not Mark Zuckerberg who bore that risk.
Right.
It was those kids who were not well served by the way that investment went down. So, there's foundations think about, reputational risk and financial risk and are they going to get return on their investment and all of those sorts of things. But it is the people who are marginalized. It is the people who are underserved. It is the people who are not getting the value out of the public resource that has been tax advantaged because the person has gotten a charitable tax deduction based on giving it. It is those people who bear the brunt of us making less than well thought through investments. So that's how I think about risk in philanthropy.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm hoping that, if it gets flipped on its head, sometimes, the risk is stronger to not do something than it is, if we go ahead and do it.
I hear you. Some big news in your world recently were those five large foundations, MacArthur, Hewlett, Ford, who basically are going to try a set of practices and commit more of their money to overhead, to administration, to programs that will make the nonprofit organization, the grantees, more effective at what they're doing. And that starvation cycle. Do you think this is going to take off or not?
Oh, Denver. this is, a generation-old conversation.
The overhead myth.
I'm hoping we'll finally find some momentum. Before I came to the Council on Foundations, I ran a group called Grantmakers for Effective Organizations that has been a champion of both full cost funding mm-hmm. and general operating support for decades. I'm very glad that these foundations have decided to go public and to fund in this way. But the fact that foundations don't do it already feels unconscionable. That foundations pick and choose which costs they think are appropriate and inappropriate feels paternalistic and isn't something that they would do, that these business people who made their money in any enterprise would do as they were building their business.
No.
Why would they do it as they're trying to fund work that is by orders of magnitude more difficult than the work that they did to make their money?
Yeah, I don't think any CEO in a business has gone into the boardroom and people said, how much did you spend on training this month?
Yeah,
you know, it's
you're
just not
exactly
the issues.
Right.
They want the bottom line. They want the end product of the impact and not how you got to the impact, as long as you did it in the ethical and a conscientious fashion.
That's exactly right.
Over this past summer, you sent a letter asking readers to help you renew the council's vision and the value to the field. What are some of the things you heard, some of the things you're considering, maybe even some of the things you're acting upon?
Oh, thanks for asking, Denver. And that's why I'm in New York, is because I was doing one more listening session with mm-hmm. New York grantmakers. And we are hearing terrific themes. One theme, very clearly folks have told us that we need to continue to be a policy voice in Washington, D.C. on behalf of the sector. And that we will clearly do.
What's at the top of that agenda at this moment?
Oh, so tax reform really hurt charitable giving. The numbers are clear now that when tax reform doubled the standard deduction, it reduced the number of itemizers, and therefore it has reduced charitable giving. So we want to help increase the incentives for charitable mm-hmm. giving again, and not just for those who are in the highest income groups. So we're pushing hard to create those incentives either through a universal charitable deduction
right.
or charitable credit.
Mm-hmm.
So that is a top policy objective for us. But on the back to the vision, in addition to being a policy voice on the Hill, folks are asking us to be a leadership voice for the sector. So when there are misconceptions about what philanthropy is and the good that it does in society, that we can provide that leadership voice and bust through some of those misconceptions.
Do you feel that the council is ready to assume that role, or do you have to do some things internally to say we got to step up and this is a big responsibility?
I think the column B. We are getting there.
Well, that's self-awareness. That's
yes,
always good.
There's definitely some internal work that we need to do, but reputationally the council is ready. Our members are asking it of us, so I think the field wants us to do it, and we are building the internal strength to be able to get there. That's not the only thing that our members want us to do. They are also asking us to help decrease the polarization and to bridge those divides,
mm-hmm.
so to lead on some of those conversations. They're also asking us to help professionalize the field by providing some of those learning opportunities for their leaders and their emerging leaders. So that's something else that we're looking to do, and also to support collaboration. So
yeah.
Many of the themes that you've already brought up with me here are the themes that our members are asking for us to lean into.
And I would imagine also they probably had some say in wanting a little bit of a new membership model, which you have implemented. Give us a highlight of that.
Yes, that was a clarion call from the members. Before I was hired as CEO, the board did a lot of listening, and a key complaint was that the previous membership model didn't feel fair.
Mm.
And so right when I came on board, we convened a member committee and did a lot of listening and have structured a new membership model built on transparency and fairness and inclusion. And so we've rolled it out, and that's why I don't know our membership numbers exactly, because it's going up,
mm-hmm.
because new people are joining on a daily basis. which is very, very good news. We built the model to honor the different kinds of philanthropic organizations that exist. These are not organizations that are that have everything in common, family foundations and private foundations and community foundations and corporate grant makers are very distinct and unique in how they're set up and where their money comes from, and therefore they needed different dues models. And so we structured it that way this time.
You came into this current role less than a year ago. After 17 years at as CEO of Grantmakers for Effective Organizations, how do you balance showing the appropriate respect and reverence for a 75-year-plus institution at the same time trying to give it a little bit of a charge and dust it off and give it a facelift at the same time? That's always a very, very tricky proposition for a new CEO. How do you think about it?
Well, I mean, the great news is that this is what the board was asking for, and this is what the field was asking for. So this is not my agenda that I'm coming in with. This is what the stakeholders are requesting of me. So there is a lot of strength to build from with the council. People feel a very close connection. You know, I hear people say, I'm glad to come home to the council when they rejoin. People have told me that some of their most meaningful professional development experiences of their career were had at the council. So it makes me proud to be in this role and to try to create that next generation of leaders who are able to say that. To whatever future CEO replaces me 20 years from now.
20 years. Well, I was looking for a timeline. How long you plan on staying in this role? I got the answer. Three more than the last one, I guess. Let me close with this, Kathleen. Boy, foundations, like any other institution, comes in for their fair share of criticism. What part of that criticism you think is really justified and we need to step up and do a better job? And what part of it you think might be a little misguided and unfair?
Yes, absolutely. I think that the critics, we should listen to them very carefully because there is certainly truth in their criticism. The insularity of philanthropy, the fact that we have not listened as carefully and well to those that we serve and integrated their voices in our decision-making is valid. It's something that we need to think very carefully about and do better at. In fact, there's an effort in philanthropy called the Fund for Shared Insight.
Yes.
That is directly
they have
on
been on
that
the show.
Issue. They have.
Yes.
Excellent. Melinda Twan.
Melinda Twan was on the show, right?
Terrific. So they are working very hard to help move that work forward, as does GEO and the Center for Effective Philanthropy. So many in our sector are trying to build those feedback loops and build the opportunity for engagement and inclusion of those that we are trying to serve. So that is a justifiable charge, and we need to work harder.
Beneficiary feedback. Who would have ever thought?
I know. It seems straightforward, but some folks don't take it as seriously as they should. They don't integrate it as deeply. They do it in a surface level way, all of those kinds of things. The things that are possibly less valid are a painting philanthropy with a very with a broad brush, presuming that we are monolithic, that we are the privileged trying to protect our own privilege. I think one thing that Anand Giridhar is known to believe
Winners
is,
Take All, the
yes,
author.
Yes, the author of Winners Take All is that, you know, that many philanthropists are doing their philanthropy kind of as cover, you know, for for the ills that they're doing.
Sort of the greenwashing type of
stuff. And these are not the philanthropists that I have met and know over my almost 18-year career in philanthropy. So he is bumping up against a very different caliber and set of people than the hundreds, if not thousands, of philanthropists that I have had the privilege of engaging with over my career.
Well, I think there are a lot of authors out there sometimes who think they're mind readers. And they know the motivation inside of all these people, and they're going to tell you what it is, even if the person doesn't know what it is.
That might be true, or that they are inferring, their inferences may not be correct.
Well, Kathleen Enright, the president and CEO of the Council on Foundations, I want to thank you so much for being here this evening. What is your website and what information do you have there you think visitors might find of interest?
Oh, yes. It's cof.org, and you can find amazing information about the legal guidance related to philanthropy, a lot of information about how to structure foundations, anything about 101 guidance around philanthropy and foundations, go there. And a lot of links to our peers and partners. There are incredible philanthropic serving organizations beyond the Council on Foundations that might also be terrific references for you.
Well, thanks, Kathleen. It was a real pleasure to have you on the show.
Thank you, Denver.
And that is this week's show. We'll be off next week for a sporting event, but we'll return on Sunday, December 29, when my guest will be David Linde, the CEO of Participant, a media company that has produced socially relevant movies such as Spotlight, The Post, and Roma. Thanks for listening. Have a wonderful holiday, and do return in 2 weeks for The Business of Giving.
The preceding program is paid for by the friends and partners of The Business of Giving.